This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Well, there's been no shortage of commentary about the structural crisis plaguing the American economic and political system, from wage stagnation and chronic unemployment to unchecked corporate and state power and growing inequality. Analyses that offer practical, politically viable solutions to these problems have been few and far between. Gar Alpovitz is a rare exception. Through his new book and film and his ongoing research and activism, Alpovitz highlights efforts already underway in thousands of communities across the U.S., from co-ops and community land trusts to municipal, state, and federal initiatives to organize and democratize capital. Alpovitz marshals years of research to show how bottom-up strategies can work to check monopolistic corporate power, democratize wealth, and empower communities. Gar Alpovitz, we welcome you to Building Bridges.
Gar, in reading What Then Must We Do, I was struck by the optimism and was delighted by it. I certainly see that best illustrated by the spark of the Occupy movement, the discontent economically. But I also can't help but juxtapose that socially and politically with, I think, a really terrifying acquiescence to the increasing militarization of the state, violent anti-immigrant and racist sentiments, the constriction of women's reproductive rights, anti-unionism. So how do you become so optimistic and suggest that we can implement the democratization of wealth?
There are real possibilities that violence will occur and there will be repression, possibly fascism. Or, like Rome, the system may just decay. So it's not a straightforward, cheery view that everything's going to be all right at all. But if you look at what's going on locally, there is a huge amount going on that amounts to socializing ownership at the community level, not state ownership, not national. Though, by the way, we did nationalize General Motors, AIG, and Chrysler and gave back two of them. We still own another one, so maybe in the future that will be done in a different way. But there are worker-owned co-op popping up almost everywhere. There are land trusts, which is essentially socializing or drawing a circle around land and capturing it for community purpose rather than giving it to the developers. That's happening all over the country. You find a very big interest now in Move Your Money to credit unions and a whole strategy. About 20 states have introduced legislation for public banks like the Bank of North Dakota. That's to say nothing of things people forget are already out there. There are something like 130 million Americans are members of traditional worker-owned co-ops and agricultural co-ops and credit unions. That's 40% of the population that could be remobilized, and in some ways it was when we start moving money to the credit unions, which are essentially co-op banks, one person, one vote banks. You know, several people that I've been running into, different organizing, are trying to reactivate those traditional institutions. And a good part of the book, What Then Must We Do, is simply pointing out this stuff is going on and is almost certain to continue to grow because the conditions are getting worse and because the traditional liberal answer, you know, I came out of liberalism in the 1960s and 70s. We'd let the corporations own the wealth and you try to tax it back or regulate them or get some social programs. That is really over. The pain levels are growing and people are forced to choose either we do something new or it will continue. And I think that process is building up, sometimes it's called the new economy strategy, but the most important characteristic is it changes and democratizes who owns wealth in a radically decentralized way. I'm not naive about it. The question is whether or not that builds over time, not whether or not tomorrow that's going to take over Congress and the presidency. It's like the prehistory of the New Deal was all done at the local level and the state level. You couldn't even see it, but something was brewing. Or the women's movement to get the vote in the 19th century, it was agonizing local and state by state by state before they got national. That's what the real subject of this book is. There is something really brewing, and its most important characteristic is it introduces into American culture, to a culture that really has almost very small socialist rhetoric or ideology left, it introduces very down-home, common sense, decentralized American ideas and experience with changing ownership, I've been traveling around, you know, all over the country with this book, and I keep running into more and more really exceptional examples of this. It's a sense that there is something brewing, and it really is characterized by who gets to own the capital. At the state level, you're seeing also the Bank of North Dakota, but 20 states have introduced legislation to do that. There's a movement in the healthcare sector, which is in really dire straits, and healthcare is going to, the cost problems are going to increase. But also, people are going to be losing their health care when corporations decide they'd rather pay the penalty than pay for the health care. But on the other hand, at the state level, 20 different states are looking at single payer, and Vermont is just about to put it into action. California enacted it twice, and Schwarzenegger vetoed it. But in that sector, almost 20% of the economy, I think there are insoluble problems which are building up are going to point towards essentially a social form of ownership. Single payer or Medicare for All is essentially a public-owned insurance company. That's what it is. It's a social ownership structure. So the book attempts to point out these various developments occurring at the local level, at the state level, in major national sectors. There are problems that are building that can only be resolved by some form of transforming ownership, and that actually you're beginning to see it. But there is a pressure really from the pain and failure of traditional programs. That's what I think is causing this, and it's beginning to take on really exciting momentum that if we build on it, I think has some potentially some real power.
You focus on cooperatives and local-level initiatives, but you also mentioned city and state-controlled enterprises that have been successful. Do these also come under your parameter?
That's a very good point. There are places where city ownership exists and is growing in different areas. The most obvious ones that people tend to forget. And this comes really out of the early part of the 20th century where there was a whole different community or municipal socialism. There are 2,000 communities where all electricity generated is under public ownership. In fact, 25% of all American electricity is under either public ownership or co-ops, essentially socialized. Another part of it is land ownership. It used to be Washington, D.C., take an example. You put in a big public investment for the mass transit system and subway system. At every single exit along the way with this huge public investment, land values are going to go way up because businesses like to locate there. It's a great place to locate high-rise housing, et cetera. It used to be you let the developers own that land. There's a huge political fight to try to tax back some of the increase, all of which came from the public investment. Many cities have changed over. They are essentially socializing the land. We call it a land trust or a land corporation, keep it in public control. And then as the land values go up, the city or the county owns that land and uses the revenues to pay back some of the public investment. Also, there are something like 400 internet services now under public development or control underway. These are just examples of the kind of thing at the neighborhood level, state level, city level. And we can come back and talk about national as well. Again, being driven by pain levels, people are either forced to do something new or the pain gets worse. But in certain areas, and we can talk about Ohio, where I've done a lot of work and our group has done a lot of work, there's been a long-term development of this worker ownership strategy to a much more sophisticated and large-scale levels than is happening.
Really do flesh out these numerous examples you've unearthed in your travels throughout this country that breathe some life into our general agreement that there has been massive systemic failure for wealth distribution and the eradication of poverty or the equality of labor with capital in this country.
400 people at the top own more wealth than the bottom 180 million. We're not going to get very far unless we change the underlying patterns of wealth ownership and do it in some way that democratizes it. And all these institutions we're talking about suggest a buildup of that idea. Clearly, it points towards what is the nature of a system that might actually achieve equality, liberty, democracy, maybe even community, and certainly ecological sustainability, that's different from state socialism and different from corporate capitalism, but very American in character. These are the ingredients that might build towards that. And there's a whole long process of evolutionary reconstruction, which would have to take place over several decades. The press isn't reporting on the reactions that are very, very interesting going on at the grassroots level, and some of them very large. In Cleveland, you'll find the most advanced form of this. In a very poor neighborhood of Cleveland, about 40,000 people, 40% unemployment, largely black, average family income 18,000. in the middle of that neighborhood, there are big hospitals and universities. Now, this is true all over the country. They've got these so-called anchor institutions. They purchase about $3 billion in goods and services a year. That's in addition to salaries, in addition to construction, just what they buy, $3 billion. In the midst of this neighborhood, there is a complex of worker-owned companies building up, in part based on the Mondragon model in the Basque Country of Spain, linked together by the nonprofit corporation. The idea is that they would kick some of their money into a community-building corporation, not just making some workers either rich or better off, but trying to build the community with some of the profits. And then there's another revolving fund. So when they make some money, they put money in so they can start more worker-owned companies. The idea is to get these big universities and hospitals to have huge taxpayer money, Medicare, Medicaid, education money, to buy from community-building, worker-owned companies. That's what's happening. These are not little co-ops. They're very sophisticated. Largest worker-owned, the largest urban greenhouse in the United States. It's hydroponic, but it is the largest urban greenhouse, 3.25 acres, under this structure of worker community ownership, produces 3 million heads of lettuce a year. To do that, you have to plant 26,000 every single day. That's one of the worker-owned companies in this complex. And another one is probably the most advanced industrial green laundry. It's aimed at hospitals and nursing homes. It uses about a third the water and a third of the heat as an ordinary hospital. The third one online right now is a solar installation company, the solar in the summer and weatherization in the winter. It's online to produce almost as much or perhaps more solar capacity than currently exists in the state of Ohio. And the idea is to build out more and more of a complex to actually build a different model of who gets to own and who gets to develop a community. And several other communities, Atlanta, there are going to be three in the Washington area. There's going to be one in Pittsburgh. There's one on the line developing very fast in Atlanta. People have caught on. This is public money, what's going into the hospitals, so-called anchor in universities. And so many cities are taking a look at these universities and hospitals and saying that could be a resource not only to kind of get some jobs here, it could create a whole different structure of ownership that is not going to run off to the suburbs, that's going to have a community-building vision, going to have an environmental vision, and it's down-home, something that people understand. You find support for rather than opposition to these developing strategies amongst a lot of people. The developmental process has gone forward such that now the steelworkers, as the international leadership, is strongly behind worker-owned companies. They're attempting to help support them. That's another developmental aspect of this. Other unions are doing the same. SEIU is helping with a laundry in Pittsburgh. And also SEIU is in part involved with the Bronx effort. There's an organizing effort attempting to set up a worker-owned complex, something like the Cleveland model. That one takes the next step. And it has some support from SEIU. We've got labor union support. And if we can get labor building on these models, which it really hasn't happened in force yet, there's also some possibility of long-term investment funding. And it's coming out, above all, out of the pain levels that are getting worse and that nobody's able to deal with it in traditional ways. So there's a whole different strategy emerging. I was at NPA, that's what people's organizing groups are going on around the country, beginning to point in this direction as well. And you see it. I was also in Chicago last week. There's a whole development in Chicago beginning to look at exactly this mix. Something's brewing in this area. And again, we're only talking about one element of this, the worker co-ops. The public banking is a whole different direction, and there are other things about land. And it's time to say what would happen if we made a commitment to trying to really develop this as an economic and political strategy with intention. So people are beginning to roll up their sleeves and developing a whole different set of ideas, potentially very promising, laying the foundations for something that could explode as, you know, the women's movement and the civil rights movement exploded and many others. Berlin Wall fell and apartheid fell and what happened in Latin America. One after another, explosions are possible, building on a whole new model, but also minimally improving people's lives. And going forward, we shall see how far we can take this.
Carl, I wanted to bring up one more point. Your book, What Then Must We Do, brings up a number of illustrations. And everybody's really got to read this book. But the one I want to focus on right now is public banking, because that's where the money is. And like you, I don't believe that the big banks can be reformed. You mentioned in the book the Bank of North Dakota and many other states that are looking into public banking. If you could flesh that out, I'd appreciate it.
It was all stimulated by the banking crisis. First, people have all of a sudden woken up and looked over there in North Dakota. For 90 years, there has been a state-owned bank operating successfully, supported by the farmers and small businessmen, too, makes money for the taxpayers, and operates effectively and efficiently. An interesting American model. People are beginning, you know, waking up to the fact that huge banks control the action throughout the country. Why not state banks? Why put taxpayers' money in Bank of America? Why not put it in a state bank and then use it to multiply and develop a real development strategy? That's one level, and there are 20 states that had legislation introduced, and probably Oregon or Washington State will be the first one to really act, beginning to use the huge resources, and maybe to set up a city credit union, as one politician has proposed, or maybe a city bank. That hasn't happened yet, but that conversation is beginning to develop. There's a big public banking conference in San Rafael, and hundreds of people all over the country are involved. And at the national level, I don't know experts left, right, or center on banking who don't think there's going to be another huge banking crisis in the next 3 to 5 years. The banks are more concentrated now than they were before the crisis. They've gotten stronger and more concentrated than they were before Dodd-Frank legislation was passed, and the Dodd-Frank legislation is filled with loopholes. When the next crisis occurs, people may learn something. Probably the next step, and many liberals are calling for this, Sherrod Brown is leading the fight, break up the big banks. The banks are too big to fail. They're not only too big to fail, the Attorney General of the United States is on record testifying. He hasn't sued anybody. And why hasn't he sued anybody? He said, including there are crimes going on. We can't sue them because they're too important to the economy. The economy is too fragile. If we sue a big bank, there could be a crisis, which means they have carte blanche to do whatever they want. And so they will continue, and almost certainly we're going to see another crisis. Maybe the next step will be break them up. But if you break them up, which I would be for, almost certainly the big fish will slowly eat the little fish and we'll be back in the same concentrations, like AT&T. The same thing happened with AT&T. It was broken up, and now it's really concentrated power again, or Standard Oil. We may go through a couple rounds of this down the next couple decades. But if it continues, and if break them up doesn't work, which is not likely to work in my opinion, at some point, the answer is going to be take them over, turn them into public utilities, because it's only option left. The power relationships are such that probably you can't regulate them, and if you break them up, they probably regroup. So at some point down the line, the argument for making them into public utilities becomes undeniable.
My emotional response is affirmative. My intellectual, or perhaps rather doctrinaire, sensitivities somehow leads me to believe that what these forms of organization degenerate into is individualism versus collectivism, decentralization rather than to democratize capital. So why do you feel that this is likely to bring a much more democratized, if not socialized, structure to the system?
It is possible that this will go nowhere. It's possible the system will decay. One logical possibility is violence will occur and we'll get repression and semi-fascist or repressive state. But it's also possible that this process, which is being pushed by pain and by failure of all the other options, it used to be you could elect some liberals and you'd get a better program, but now it's even cutting Social Security. The pain is increasing and people are forced to either do something new or the pain gets worse. That's the driver here. It is also introducing a very different principle into American life, that we can do democratic ownership. Co-ops, local banks, land trusts, public utilities is part of America, and we can do that in a country that has very little socialist ideology. But practically introducing the democratization idea is in fact happening around the country. There's millions of people in co-ops and et cetera. That's to say nothing of worker-owned companies, another 11 million people involved. If over time we can expand and develop and make real in ordinary life in local communities the trends that are beginning to develop, the basis for something larger might be available. I don't think you're going to jump to regional or national, except, you know, we did nationalize General Motors and Chrysler. That may happen again. We still actually own AIG, the largest insurance company in the world, is socialized, publicly owned currently. When these crises develop at some point, if there is a base that's built, not only of knowledge and experience, but also of decentralization, that something that is truly American and decentralized and democratic, there is a possibility over time of beginning to move towards either a fulfillment of that vision or partial steps in that direction or movement and development of parts of the economy that begin to look more and more like what you might want. It gets very interesting. If a city like Cleveland, which has gone from 900,000 to less than 400,000 over the last three decades, can do what they're doing in Cleveland, you can probably do it where you are if you roll up your sleeves. There are about 10, 12 communities now trying to do what the Cleveland model, but trying to go beyond it. You could do this in the Bronx, and in fact, there's a big project developing in the Bronx. And you can do it in Amarillo, Texas, where there's another big project of the Cleveland-style model. An ordinary American groundwork is being developed. The movement amongst lots of people on the left looking at worker co-ops now as a decentralized way to begin thinking about building on the Mondragon model in the Basque Country of Spain. There's a very hot discussion going on of all of this, both amongst progressives who are not socialists, and also socialists are beginning to look at this kind of phenomenon and how far it could go in the country if we really developed it.
You really need to say something about the Mondragon model since you mentioned it several times.
Mondragon is a development in the Basque region of Spain. It's been developing for 55 years. It is an extremely sophisticated group of more than 100 integrated co-ops. Some are very high-tech. They do advanced medical equipment building, for instance. Some of them are construction. Some of them are supermarkets. You name it, it's like a multinational corporation. There are 85,000 people working in it. And it is a cooperative, but a very sophisticated, large-scale, integrated, participatory democracy cooperative competing successfully in the world market. There's virtually no unemployment in the Basque area. There's 26% in the rest of Spain. The governing structure is a very participatory structure. They have their own banking system. The ratio of income from top to bottom in 85% of the co-ops is something of the order of 5 to 6 to 1, top to bottom. Big corporations, the ratio may be 300 or 400 to 1 from the top to the bottom, whereas Mondragon is 5 to 6 to 1. Highly successful, very sophisticated, very advanced development work, and a model that many people are realizing tells you something different can be done if you get serious. You know, the two strategies people have had in their minds about how political economic change occurs is, one is called, you know, quotes around the word reform. Equate that with liberalism, if you like. The idea was they get to own the capital, 400 people in the big corporations, and we put together enough muscle and the labor unions do political work, try to reform and control and manage them. But you don't change the structure, you just try to manage it. The reform model was, we'll have cycles back and forth, the conservatives will come in and hopefully there'll be another cycle of change. I don't think that's where it's going anymore. The other model was revolution. The economy collapses, and then there's a big explosion, and there's a revolution. That model probably also is not likely, largely because in 1929, the floor under the economy, the government floor, was only 11%. And now it's up in the 30, 34% range. So we may get stagnation, but probably not a big collapse. And indeed, if we had a huge collapse of the kind of 1930s, it may just as well go to the right as it did in Europe rather than we got lucky there was a conservative in power so the liberals could take advantage of the collapse. So if you don't have the traditional reform where they, and you don't have traditional revolution, but you have a long decaying period of this evolving transformation maybe, and the term I've been using is evolutionary reconstruction, building, changing, and democratizing ownership of capital, co-ops and worker-owned companies and public utilities and land trusts and public banks and all the things that we're talking about. It's an evolving reconstruction process with occasional punctuations, like a big banking crisis where you may get a flip and there may be a takeover in some cases. But the building process is very democratic and long-term. So all of this is kind of, the Mondragon example is the most advanced, but I think in some ways the Cleveland development adds to Mondragon because Mondragon doesn't use public purchasing power as a major mechanism. It takes you even beyond Mondragon in certain ways because Mondragon's out there in the open market globally fighting and in some places really under attack by low-cost Chinese production and East European production. There's a more sophisticated development of a stabilizing mechanism when you start using quasi-public money in hospitals and universities to help stabilize worker-owned companies that may even take us another step. It's a learning process if we can continue it and build on it. The way to think about it is, again, my heroes are the civil rights workers, most of whose names we don't know, who were working in the 1930s and 40s. You know, when the really tough, they would hang you easily from a tree if you stepped out of line, you know, after they tortured you. those are the people who laid the foundations for what became the civil rights movement in the 1960s. You know, just possibly what you're seeing develop around the country is that sort of analogy. People really doing really hard work now, introducing new forms, some of which are going to fail. There's going to be a lot of failure and trial and error, trying to come up with a different way to own capital than either corporate capitalism or state socialism, trying to build in a very American way from the bottom up. So I think of these folks like the civil rights workers in the 30s and 40s who did that hard, hard ground-laying work. And you're absolutely right. It is possible that it'll go nowhere. But it's also possible that no matter what, it helps people in places like Cleveland or all where this is happening, but other parts of the country where it's happening. I mentioned several, many, many cities and rural areas. I was just out down in Atlanta and then also in North Carolina. There's a whole rural side of this developmental process going on. It's also possible that something real is beginning to happen, and minimally it helps folks in great pain. So, yeah, the book is optimistic in that sense, but it's cool and realistic about we'll see how far it goes. It partly depends on how much we roll up our sleeves and get behind stuff that's already emerging without benefit of our concern or ideas. It's coming out of the ground.
And the best way to get more information, obviously, is to read the book, What Then Must We Do, and also go to your website, which is?
There's one website for the book, whatthenmustwedo.org. And then if you want information on how to build, you know, all these things, there are groups now around the country who can tell you about how to do a public utility or a worker co-op or you name it. Go to this website, community-wealth.org. Put the dash in because there's one without the dash. The Media Education Foundation has also done a film that's come out in connection with the book, and it's called The Next American Revolution. If you go to the website, The Next American Revolution, you can download it.
Gar Alperov, thank you very much, giving us a sense of optimism that the endurance of this tremendously unequal system of capital is not ever enduring, and there are things that can be done to democratize this society. It's really been a pleasure.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.